Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately!
Where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video. Find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Get ready, Ohio. FanDuel, America's number one sports book, is coming to the Buckeye State. And to kick things off, you can get started with $100 in free bets as an early sign-up bonus. Plus, when you sign up today with promo code OHIOFD, you'll be all set when FanDuel goes live in Ohio. Then you can bet on all your favorite teams in all your favorite sports with $100 in free bets. Just download FanDuel's top-rated sportsbook app. It's safe, secure, and super easy to use. Ohio, this is your chance to get in on the action. Join today with promo code OHIOFD. Make every moment more with FanDuel, official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 or older and present in Ohio. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable free bets that expire 7 days after FanDuel accepts its first real money sports wager in Ohio, 1/1/23. Unique user identity verification required. Offer ends on the go live date. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Breaking up is hard to do, but when it comes to your wireless carrier, you should have left a while ago. You're over the big three carriers. You deserve better. Xfinity Mobile. Now you can get unlimited with 5G included for just $30 a month on the nation's fastest, most reliable network. So break free from the big three and save with Xfinity Mobile.
Take the savings challenge at xfinitymobile.com/mysavings to see how much you can save when you get Xfinity Mobile and internet together. Reduced speeds at 20 gigabytes per line. Most reliable based on Root Metrics U.S. report. Results vary, not an endorsement.
At Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture, and when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space, just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in-store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
All right, it's film study once again. We're still looking at preseason football, looking back at week three. Going to take a look at the offense yesterday, or today, from 2 days ago. If you missed yesterday's podcast, you want to check that out as we broke down the defense and had a great hour-plus conversation about the defense from this game. But today we're going to break down the offense. Ken McCusick, how you doing?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I can't complain. I mean, it's a Saturday in 90-degree Florida weather. It's okay. It's not bad. So, all right, we got a guest tonight, like we do every night. I like this rotation of guests. It's working out really well, and it's real nice to hear different people's opinions and viewpoints. And we've got Jonas Schaefer from the Baltimore Sun joining us, who's been spending a whole lot of time over at the Castle. Jonas, how's it going?
Well, likewise, I woke up to about 60-degree weather, so much better than the past.
Yeah, I don't know. 60-degree weather sounds really nice, considering that my phone has said feels like triple digit every day since I've been down here.
Yeah, it's been one very, very, very nice year.
All right, so we're going to get into, I guess, Jonas, before we even dig into preseason, can you introduce yourself, kind of what you're doing over at the Sun?
Yeah, sure. Well, since last year, I've been the lead beat writer at the Baltimore Sun, filling in the very large footsteps of one Jeff Zrebeck, who left for something called The Athletic. Just doing the normal beat stuff that a reporter does for us. Features, analyses, notes, breaking news, witty tweets, all the good stuff you could possibly want.
So it's great, great stuff, Jonas. And I've appreciated your writing for a lot of reasons, but I just want to key the readers into who Jonas is a little bit. He's a very analytic guy. So you're going to hear some stuff and analysis on this program that, you know, give you an idea that he's maybe a little bit different from other Sun writers that have been there over the years. And I'm not putting anybody down, but I'm just saying he's a little different in that respect. He's also an insider from the Castle. And one of the things we really want to get from you is an update on the Ravens' health from today's practice.
Yeah, well, good news and bad news. I guess the good news is that obviously one big focus of the preseason has been the health of the offensive line. There was a little bit more concern than usual this past week with Ronnie Stanley being out for most of those joint practices against the Eagles. Obviously, Marshall Yanda has continued to kind of be sidelined by just, you know, old guard stuff. He also had a bit of a foot and ankle problem injury. But both of those guys were back at practice today, didn't seem to be bothered at all by the lower body stuff that they've been dealing with. Jermaine Illuminor, however, is still out, so obviously that left guard problem that has been a brewing for the past month or so is still not resolved, doesn't really seem all that close. Elsewhere, you know, the same kind of injuries that have been lingering, Randy Gracilius out, Greg Sinnott obviously out. They would need that depth along the line for this next upcoming game against the Redskins. Jalen Ferguson out. Jeff Zrebeck reported that he's in concussion protocol, so you hope that it's nothing too major there. Obviously, Nick Grigsby waived. Paul Warlow, his contract terminated, but I know we'll get into that. And then Brandon Carr, Maurice Kennedy, Amon Marshall out, safety Earl Thomas also out. You hope that it's nothing too serious with those guys. Obviously, Amon Marshall has been out for a couple weeks now, and he might be an IR candidate just from the writing on the wall. But I think more positive than negative coming out of today's practice.
All right. Amon Marshall, let's go back to him for a second. Is his a concussion as well, or is it another type of injury?
We don't know. I think it's still undisclosed as to what it is. But I think, gosh, he's been out probably coming up on 2 weeks now. And, you know, I haven't really seen him on the sideline for games, which is obviously worrisome. So, you know, it might be a Jaleel Scott situation from last year, where if they just want to, you know, take their chances with not having him on the roster or being able to practice this year, they might just put him on the IR. But again, that's just conjecture from me.
Right. That's always a shame when I see that happening to a promising rookie player. And he's a highly thought of corner, very physical, yeah, and could really use those NFL practice reps, you know, in this year one, even if he only plays a few snaps or is a full season inactive, as Jordan Lasley was last year, he'd get the benefit of the practice at least.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned Warlow really briefly. A very curious case there, because as I understand it, he retired to be with his wife, who's 8 months pregnant, and it seemed like she was probably 8 months and 29 or 7 months and 29 days pregnant when he signed the contract a day ago, and probably knew that all this was something that really wasn't going to work out.
Maybe, but I guess maybe she just told him. Maybe he just found out.
Yeah, that is the curious thing. I mean, you know, never having had a partner who is pregnant, I don't know exactly, you know, for most people when their partner starts to show, but I know it's no later than a couple or several months. So, you know, you do the math, and you kind of get to figuring when exactly 9 months is, and you look at the NFL calendar, and you think that with the help that these guys have, agents, managers, whatever, you know, they'd be able to do that kind of calculus and figure out just whatever it is that they want to do. But, you know, if it is true, obviously you want every NFL player to put their family life over their NFL life, but it is still a kind of curious 24 hour in and then you're out.
Yeah. All right. We got to witness a pretty bad football game. I don't want to beat the heck out of that dead horse any more than we have. Obviously a very bad week around the league, but no Lamar Jackson, no Carson Wentz. I did think that this win over the Eagles was still pretty good. The Eagles' defensive line on both is very formidable, and the offensive line, they played mostly their starters with Brandon Williams sitting out for the Ravens on that defensive side, and Patrick Ricard, you know, starting effectively in his place.
Yeah, and we were talking in the press box just how much maybe that is a reward for Patrick Ricard, how much of a kind of stick it is for Willie Henry. Obviously, Henry had gotten a lot of praise early in camp, mainly because he was healthy, because he was light, he was looking good. But, you know, you do wonder if this were week one of regular season, where both would be on that depth chart. Because, I mean, I know you talked about it at length on this podcast and in your film study, there really hasn't been a more impressive breakthrough guy than Pat Ricard. And Willie Henry's just kind of quietly done his job, maybe gotten a couple in hurries or pressures here and there, but if they think that more reps equal more production for Ricard in the long haul, then obviously you want to get him as many reps as you possibly can out there.
Another theory I had about that was Ricard got the start as a reward for eating a bunch of defensive snaps in this game. I don't honestly believe Ricard is going to play too much defensive line this year.
Yeah,
we'll see, but I don't really believe it. I think there's too many kind of situations where he's not exactly the best guy. Like, he's a big guy and he can be a little bit stout against the run, but he's not as big as either Pierce or Williams, and he's never going to be the five tech interior rusher that you get from either Wormley or from Henry.
Right.
So, you know, it just doesn't seem like he's an obvious guy in any particular situation. But what was really valuable is he came in and he ate 24 snaps or whatever it was in this game, and they otherwise would have had to get those from somebody else, and Brandon Williams wasn't available. So gave some rest to the starters.
And he got some good pressures, too. I mean, I think he forced that lateral fumble, whatever you want to call it, that I think ended up going for, what, minus 10 yards or something?
Minus 10. That wasn't even a quarterback hit. And then he got another actual quarterback hit. So two big, pretty good quarterback poundings to his credit in that game.
He's a big boy.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, I do want to talk about one particular problem that really stood out to me in this game with the Ravens, and that's at offensive tackle, where we went into the season, you have Stanley, you have Orlando Brown coming off a good rookie year, and you think everything is going to be fine. The Ravens finally have their tackles figured out. Now it's just this darn interior offensive line they have to figure out. But as of the game on Thursday, the Ravens, as particularly after it, the Ravens had a problem with every single offensive tackle on the roster, whether it was injury or effectiveness. So let's just to go through these. Orlando Brown was on the field. He played the entire first half against the Eagles. He wasn't particularly effective as a pass blocker in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking over the first half, and I think hold it against him for that holding call? Because I thought that was just kind of a situation where obviously his hands were in the right spot, but that looked to me like a situation where McSorley kind of ran the defensive end into the holding call. Obviously, like I said, his hands should be in the guy's chest plate, not around him. But I think, you know, he did everything he needed to until McSorley started to escape. And at that point, because of where the ref was looking and where Brown's hands were, there was no choice but to throw the flag. But yeah, I mean, like, there was the there was the sack near the end of the half for Sharif Miller. I'm not sure if Miller was the one who was credited for it, but the one that they eventually wiped out because of the hands to the face against McSorley, that didn't look good. And then even on some running plays, like he missed a block early on when they were kind of backed up in their own territory. And that Matt Skurek kind of had to abandon his block because he had to chase down the weak side guy. There was a call in the second quarter where it looked like maybe McSorley had kind of told his line to block to the left because everyone kind of at the snap of the ball shifted left, but the DE, the defensive end that was just right across from him, dipped around him like Brown thought that maybe Hayden Hurst or Justice Hill would get him, and it was just a clear shot to Trace McSorley. That might have also been an RPO, but again, it was really tough to tell, and you want to give Orlando the benefit of the doubt, but taken with the context of just of this game, it was definitely a little bit worrisome. And you know, I totally agree that there really isn't, until you get Ronnie Stanley back, a totally dependable tackle out there.
Right. And you know, in Brown's case, I think there are other environmental factors that are having a contribution to this. Is that when he's playing with Yanda, Yanda can make up for a lot of sins. In right. fact, if your footwork is bad, you can kind of be bad to the inside, and Yanda will often bail you out on that block, where that would normally be death to a tackle to really expose his inside. And, you know, the same thing on the other side. The unsettled left guard position has meant the left tackle has been left out on island, and it's been some not very good left tackles, particularly in this game, that were not up to the task. You know, they're not playing together as an offensive line just in general. You know, you gain that cohesion. You mentioned the Skura change of line call. That's the kind of thing, if everybody's playing together, they understand what's going on. Or somebody like Yanda, who's in there, says, well, hold on, recall that kind of thing. Anyway, you got a good chance to get it right otherwise. And, right. you know, when we come right down to it at the end, the Eagles' defensive front is very impressive. And they have, you know, two deep defensive ends that are good that were playing all the way to the end of this game.
Yeah, I mean, are we ready to start talk about the Vinnie Curry situation first? Boy, I mean, it was not pretty early on. I think it was... Wasn't it back-to-back? You had that, again, the Ravens drive that started deep in their own territory. They lined up in that diamond formation. Justice Hill got the handoff to his left, and Vinnie Curry just whipped him. You know, there might have been a big hole to the left. I think maybe Boyle was leading the charge down there, and they might have had like a kind of 5 to 10 yard gain, but Hill just had to completely change course, basically, because Curry was right there and because Hurst hadn't done his job. And then on the next play, McSorley, you know, drops back to pass, and Vinnie Curry just puts James Hurst on skates. He basically walks him back to McSorley's foot, you know, toenails, essentially. And it looked like it was a screen pass all the way, but I'm not sure if Trace wanted to get that out as soon as he did, because it looked like by the time Justice Hill got it, there wasn't really the kind of blocks that in front of him that he was expecting. And then just toward the end of the draft, toward the end of the half, rather, another pressure allowed for Curry. And then end of the half, Josh Sweat, I also had him just walking him back against McSorley. So you can kind of see why he might be better suited against guys with shorter wingspans playing inside, but it definitely was not encouraging.
Yeah, you're impressive going over this block by block, and I'm reading my own score sheet. We just did it. Hurst scored a .44 on this, 2.5 pressures allowed. One penetration that you mentioned on the big bubble that he forced on Hill's run that didn't go anywhere, loss of one on that play. But I'm in agreement that basically on all the things you're telling me about. There are three missed blocks in the game he had as well. So it was a really unimpressive half of football. He only played 25 snaps. And, you know, .44 is an F any way you look at it, not close to any other grade. I just don't think the good that could come out of this game is that if Hurst is healthy, this ought to be a 5-alarm fire that he cannot go back to left tackle as part of any solution this year.
Yeah, so, it also might be that, you know, we have to give him, I think, somewhat of the benefit of the doubt. You know, maybe he wasn't planning to play left tackle until the coaches told him Tuesday. And, you know, you have a full week during our normal game week to study guys and to kind of know how to anchor and to know what to expect against a guy like Vinnie Curry. But obviously, you can only change so much about yourself physically And I think those shortcomings were definitely exposed in a big way Thursday.
Yeah. I mean, he's a swing guard tackle. I think it's part of the job description to be able to do both jobs in any particular game. And he's a guy I don't expect to be starting. It could happen. He could be the fallback back at left guard come week one. It's certainly not impossible. But I think the better choice is that he's a backup guard and backup right tackle. But this really gets us to some of the other problems on the roster. Illuminor, his injury is very significant because he's the swingman who can actually play left tackle and had done a good job of it.
Yeah, yeah, he has. I mean, he's got the size to be out in the middle. And then I think we've seen just with how well he's pulled that he's got the feet to be out there at left tackle. He's certainly got the size to anchor against maybe the kind of guys that James Hurst can't. But I mean, as I was telling you guys before we hopped on, it is tough to tell exactly what's wrong with it because he left Monday's joint practice against Philadelphia. Early on, he was kind of doubled over in some pain. It was very, very hot out there. I think the Philly International Airport had a heat index over 100. It was just brutally hot. He's obviously a guy who had some conditioning problems entering camp. He failed the conditioning test heading into it. He had to wait a day or two to pass it. They've been trying to get him down to a certain weight. He's talked openly that he knew he should have done better. But if you can't handle 30 or 40 minutes in the heat, then, you know, summers are, you know, falls in Baltimore can be kind of unforgiving. I mean, that there are going to be some very hot Sundays out there. And when he got carted off the field about an hour into camp, it was tough to tell exactly what was wrong because, you know, from him being bent over, it looked like it might be heat exhaustion. Maybe it was an upper body injury. But again, you would think that he would be able to walk off and head to the training room. But it is just tough to tell what the problem is with him. But obviously the coaches are very frustrated and no one's really offering any compliments to him for what he's gone through because he still hasn't really achieved anything close to what the coaches think he's possible of.
Okay. Now, what you're saying is interesting to me. There's two things. First of all, he rode off in the cart as opposed to riding off lying down in the back of the cart. His passenger seat, right?
I think he was kind of on the truck bed or whatever you want to call it.
Okay. But like reclining on the truck bed or sitting on the edge of the truck bed or what?
Okay. I think he was just sitting on the, I don't think he was reclining.
Okay. All right. So that's better. So that at least tells me it might not be a knee. If the coaches are pissed off at him about this, that's the better kind of injury that he can recover from. It's not good to be in the doghouse, but it's better in terms of it might be a conditioning issue or it might be a he doesn't want to work hard issue, which hopefully they can correct. But if it's some sort of injury involving his knee or a foot injury, God forbid, then that's very serious for an offensive lineman and is something he might not play this season if it's that.
Right, right. I think especially with his weight, you will definitely want to hope that it is not a foot injury because, you know, force equals mass times acceleration.
There you go. And
there's a lot of mass on that body.
Yeah. Okay. So we talked about Illuminor. Stanley obviously has been injured, returned to practice today. That's great news. But, you know, he's had an injury history, obviously, and that left tackle is a position where the Ravens are going to need a backup. If Illuminor is not the guy, then, you know, Gregory Sinnott is maybe next down on the list of people that could play that position. I don't think it should be Hurst. If it can't be Illuminor, then I think they probably have to think about keeping Gregory Sinnott on the roster. Now, Sinnott played well in that first game, had a holding call, but otherwise had a good game. And the thing that he's missed the last two games, and he would be normally he'd be losing a lot of ground for missing games like that. But the truth of the matter is the Ravens are so desperate at left tackle, I don't really think he's losing that much ground.
Yeah, I mean, the trouble is just he hasn't been all that great in training camp. Or training camp's obviously now over, and this injury has just made it very, very tough to be able to tell exactly where he is in his development. And as you remember last year, there were problems also with his lower body. He got in trouble, some hot water with John Harbaugh for tweeting out a photo of his foot in a walking boot, and John Harbaugh kind of blew a gasket about that. Obviously he has the kind of prototypical background that you would want in a developmental tackle. Obviously he played basketball, Wagner. He looks good just kind of walking around without pads. He looks like a guy who could play anywhere along the line, just physique wise. But he was having some trouble with some of these, kind of first slash second string edge rushers that the Ravens have, you know, the non-McPhee crowd, basically, as I would put it. And obviously that may be a testament to just how good this kind of overlooked group of pass rushers actually is. But obviously he still has a lot to learn from an NFL, you know, intellectual standpoint, I guess is how I would put it, versus someone like James Hurst, who, even though he might not be physically gifted, you can depend on him to execute the play call, you know, 95 out of 100 times.
Right. Now, another guy who's around, is probably not expected to make the roster, is Chris Ilias. But he was a guy last year who had played left tackle during the preseason, and he did not look bad in his playing time during the preseason last year, is my recollection. It looked as if he could be a guy who you'd put on the practice squad, and if in dire need, you'd bring him up.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who, like, if you were kind of comparing it to a TV show, all we've basically seen of him is the pilot. You know, it was just, I think, one or two practices at training camp, and he's just been sidelined ever since. And poor guy, we kind of joke among the Ravens reporters that one of these days we're going to ask exactly what Randon's injury is, but he's just so far down the depth chart that it just never kind of occurs to us when we're up there just asking John Harbaugh about more pressing matters. So, I mean, I feel bad for him if it is a serious injury. He's been out there on the sideline for all the games, so obviously it's not something that's kept him off his feet. But, you know, he would be, I think, a huge, huge long shot at this point to make the 53-man roster, regardless of how banged up the Ravens' better tackles are.
Right. I agree with that. They have options, obviously, to go to the waiver wire another place. We'll talk about that in a minute. Applefield played the entire second half. In fact, he played that last drive of the first half, which was the Ravens' longest drive of the game. He looked pretty bad at left tackle, particularly as a pass blocker. Prince, on the other side, has been bad every time he's been in the games. I really just don't have anything nice to say about him. He's faced some tough left defensive ends and left outside linebackers over on that side, but still, he really has not gotten it done. And I don't think either of them is a guy you keep on the practice squad. I don't think either of them is the sort of guy that just didn't quite make it and you might need him later kind of thing. Makari, he's that kind of guy. Maybe Cresilius was had he been healthy. Sanat certainly is if he doesn't make the team. But I just don't see either of those guys as being an option for the practice squad.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of you get what you pay for. Both of those guys, undrafted free agents, haven't really flashed. I think Prince looks a little bit better, has looked a little bit better so far in training camp. But I agree, both just kind of unremarkable so far from what we've seen in practice and in preseason.
All right. So if the Ravens are going to fix this tackle situation, they have three main ways to do it. One is get the current players healthy, which Stanley returning to the field is a big part of that. And they've got to get some good news on the Illuminor and Sanat front before long. I mean, we are 15 days from an opener in Miami, and you want to talk about heat and Illuminor, if the issue is heat, I don't think that's the great place for him to start the season either.
No.
Sanat, maybe with his body type, a little more heat resistant, whatever, but there's got to be somebody to back up tackle even in that very first game, or I don't even know what they do. I'm not even sure if Hurst would back up a left tackle, or they move Brown to the left side, or what they might do. But
yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of it depends again on this kind of issue of whether they keep 8 or 9 linemen. Because I mean, this would be just the ultimate emergency option. But Pat McCary did play tackle for a Pac-12 program for a couple of years there. So I don't know how much the protections change for a guy going from the interior of the line to to a tackle spot for the Ravens, just whether it's a whole new kind of set of rules to learn, basically. But if need be, and he was on the 53-man roster, he is a guy who you could hypothetically put out there and maybe have a chance to hold your own.
Right. The issue with Makari is arm length. And he doesn't have NFL arm length for a tackle, even though he got by with it at Cal, right? Cal is where he played. And I like the idea that he could be your emergency, but he's at the emergency level of having Patrick Ricard jump in at guard if you need him. I mean, it's that
your
kind of
theory.
Yes. So
I hope the Ravens. I don't want to wish injury on anyone, but I hope that they do reach a point where they're either up 45-0 or down 45-0, and they say, "I'll screw it," or, "Oh shoot, we have no other option," and they have to put in Ricard. I know your head would explode, wouldn't it?
It would be fun. It would be fun. All right. So anyway, the other possibilities, and they're still open there, are trade or waiver claim. And there is a shortage of offensive line talent, of course, league-wide. A couple of years ago, we saw some ridiculous prices paid for tackles at the end of camp. It's as if, you know, there was a shortage and, you know, gas prices are at $7 a gallon or whatever. It was like that, with a sixth-round draft pick for some really weak offensive line talent. Waiver claim is possible as well, of course. So there'd be a lot of teams in that. The Ravens, having made the playoffs last year, would be low in the waiver order to make that claim. But they do have draft capital. So if they want to trade for someone, I think, you know, it's probably two positions, offensive tackle and slot corner, are both places where it would make sense to pick somebody up.
Yeah, I mean, this is where all that wheeling and dealing that we've talked about that's netted them so many picks for next year's draft could really come in handy, right? I mean, that Corey Vedvik trade could be worth its weight of gold. I mean, it's obviously already kind of worth its weight, considering that didn't he go 0-for-2 tonight? I think for
Did he? I saw he missed his first from about 43 yards. I didn't see this.
Yes, he missed both.
I think he went. Wow. The second one was a 52 or 53 yarder, so it's tough to hold it against him. But you know, obviously that trade looks good, at least better by the week right now, and I don't know what the kind of going rate, what a fifth round pick or sixth or seventh would get you kind of at that roster deadline. But with the draft capital that they've amassed, they definitely have some options to work with.
Well, I have some rules about that. You can exchange players of a surplus always. If you have a surplus player that you're going to cut, it's usually a seventh or a conditional seventh that's worth. If you want to go up a little bit in class and get somebody better, you have to find a team that's ambivalent to lose that player, much like the Ravens were with Vedvik, supposedly. Mm-hmm. But they might have kept him as a punter or whatever, yada, yada. But that they're ambivalent to lose him. And in that situation, you might be able to get something better. And the guy the Ravens still have that they might have been ambivalent to lose would be Jimmy Smith. That if they still had Tavon healthy,
right,
that they might have been willing to trade him for a fourth round pick, say. So that's if you look at what they're, you know, what you can get, I think that's kind of the level you'd be looking to trade, a fourth or a fifth. It was a fourth round pick for Josh Wilson several years ago. He'd be perfect for this team right now. He's exactly what the Ravens need to plug their current problem. So if there's a team out there that has a big surplus of corners, maybe you find the trade partner.
Right. I know the Ravens and at least this was the policy with Ozzie Newsome in the past. They've been among the last teams to kind of shed their guys on the roster fringes. But, you know, other teams might be a little bit more expeditious in terms of, you know, cutting players in the week or the days or the hours leading up to that deadline. Whereas with the Ravens, you know, even going up to that, you know, second to last practice, there's still a good amount of guys. Way, way more than the 53 that you need out there on the practice field compared to other teams that, you know, have done their work earlier. And maybe that makes the Ravens' job easier, makes their job harder. Who knows? We'll see.
So there's a practice on cutdown day this year? Shouldn't be, right?
I don't know. It's a Saturday. The deadline's 4 p.m. I think in the past, at least last year, it wasn't, but I could be mistaken.
Yeah, so the coach is needed in the office to basically say goodbye to these guys one at a time.
Right.
So I'd be surprised at that. But I assume you'll be in the building, and we'll be looking forward to your tweets.
I think they always have a day of press conference, or it might be the day after. We'll see.
All right. All right. So, you know, if we look at the rest of the offensive line, I guess we've beaten this tackle thing to death. If we look at the rest of the offensive line, I think the order of entry into the game in the preseason is always interesting. And there's one particular that interested me this week because Hurst played basically most of the first half. Applefield then came in for the last drive, plus the rest of the game. Nothing really surprising there. Bozeman and Powers played the entire game at Bozeman at left guard and then center, and Powers at right guard, then left guard. But Skura played the first five drives, same as Hurst, before coming out, which to me was surprising. He's a starter. He doesn't really need to play that much. The Ravens had been pimping Makari as a, you know, potential option on the interior line and gave him the full evaluation treatment in the previous game. he didn't play great, but he wasn't awful either. And it seemed like this would be another opportunity to get him more snaps in this game. And having him not enter until the last drive of the first half is fairly late to see what he can do.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways that you can look at that. You can look at it from the John Harbaugh is just a competitive, uber competitive coach. You know, I think against Green Bay, Mark Andrews was out close toward, was still playing toward the end of the first half, and he's a guy who you absolutely want to protect. Mm-hmm. I mean, God forbid him, you know, playing one play longer than he absolutely has to, considering all the good work that he's done in training camp and in practice. And that just might be because John Harbaugh really likes having those starters out there and building cohesion. You can also look at it from a more cynical perspective and say, hey, the Ravens kind of sort of like what they have in Mekari. They want to give him enough reps where he's comfortable out there, but not so much, not so many reps that there's enough film on him that other snooping around teams can really scoop him up if they indeed try to, you know, stash him away on the practice squad. It might be, you know, punishment for maybe Mekari not having as good a week as he had in the past. There are just so many different avenues, probably a confluence of those factors that goes into the decision-making process for that offensive line rotation.
Okay, lots of possibilities. I think the second one is the most realistic, is that it's an attempt to hide him for potentially a week on the practice squad. And one of the things, we talked about this a little bit with Sarah, but not everybody understands that if you don't start on the 53-man roster, if you instead go to IR before the final 53 is set, then you are not eligible to be returned from IR. You have season-ending IR if you last. So you have to be on that roster to start the season. Well, Mekari is a guy, you can also put somebody on the practice squad and then return them, of course. But Mekari is one of those guys, and maybe McSorley is one as well, who you could put on the practice squad, hope to have them survive a week there, and then bring them back because you're hoping somebody else who you're planning to put on IR, you can keep on there for 1 week and then move him to IR.
Yeah, and I was trying to kind of game this out in my head about a week or so ago when Mekari seemed to really be making his move, but there was also the possibility that this was just all for show or trying to, you know, send a warning to Luminor that he better get his stuff in order. You know, I don't know how much one or two good preseason games is really going to, whether that's really going to be enough to get Mekari on some other team's radar. I think if you're a team looking for help, you want a guy who can perform, which Mekari probably can, but you also want a guy who's healthy. And I think that's where the possible red flag comes in. I mean, we saw with James Hurst and that back injury just how problematic injuries of that type can be for linemen. And Makari's a guy who had to miss all of mandatory minicamp with a back injury. He got healthy in time for the start of training camp, so credit to him. But I think he also had an upper body injury toward the end of his Cal career that knocked him out in late November. I think it was a broken arm or something with the shoulder. So that's two relatively serious injuries in the past year, the past calendar year. And, you know, if you're a GM, do you really want to be spending a 53-man roster spot on a guy like that who could probably hack it as a backup guard, but maybe if, you know, he has one bad, you know, day of practice, one unlucky day of practice, I should say, is back to the IR and you're just kind of back at square one. There's just a whole lot of factors to consider when you're talking about a guy like Mekari.
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, the injury history is obviously something that will weigh against him on other teams' boards, but there's certain teams, and the Ravens are one of them, looking at the Ravens for offensive line players, looking at the Ravens for defensive line players. I think also look coming out of this year, if the Ravens were to cut a safety by surprise, like say Chuck Clark were to get cut, you know, that he would be jumped on by other teams. But
absolutely.
Yeah. But anyway, we digress. I mean, the guy who was most claimed last year was Carl Davis, who had 6 waiver claims made on him across the NFL. Just the end of the Ravens defensive line group is certainly a popular set.
Yeah. And I mean, along those lines, obviously, I know we're talking offense tonight, but you do wonder just how many teams would possibly consider that they could work a miracle with someone like Gerald Willis, if indeed mm-hmm. he is healthy enough to play in Thursday's game. But again, he was out again today, so we'll see. But you know, he fell out of the draft for a reason, and we've kind of only seen him flash in bits in bits and pieces so far. So who knows if the Ravens would also be able to hold on to a guy like him.
Okay, so in particular in Willis's case, do you get the impression that any of that is a dog in Willis? Because I've only heard good things, including Harbaugh's tweet to Willis about he's doing the right thing, just keep doing it every day kind of thing.
Yeah, I was kind of joking with Aaron Kucinich, the Penn Live reporter who wrote that might have been the highlight of Willis's training camp, because it seems like since that story went out, he really hasn't had a good day. I think he was good enough in training camp to merit that kind of praise. And, you know, it's really tough to kind of guess and maybe backdate your sort of injury examinations. But if it was a kind of lingering injury thing that just got worse and worse and worse, and it started right after that article got published, then maybe that could explain him not really having a whole lot of effectiveness and certainly not getting a lot of snaps. So I don't think he had any real bad injury troubles at Miami. It was more so the off the field stuff that was a red flag with him, you know, switching from Florida to Miami and then him punching out Marty Wernigke's son. Who can forget that? But, you know, he just really hasn't been remarkable at all. So who knows? I mean, obviously they need to get him out there. He's going to, if he's healthy enough to play Thursday, they'll probably try to just see whether he's worth anything, because they're not going to run any starters out there.
Right. I mean, he's a player, honestly, he's a great game four starter, because I think the Ravens honestly would be somewhat ambivalent to whether he went on IR or not. There's other players that are on the fringe of the roster more that they really don't want to pay on IR. But Willis, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if they had to pay him for an IR year. It wouldn't be great if they didn't want to, but it wouldn't be the worst thing.
Right. And I think we talked about this offline, just the fact that, you know, he's a guy who is built a little bit more like your five technique pass rusher. Mm-hmm. Someone like Dalen Mack is the potential next in line after Michael Pierce, after Brandon Williams. Whereas Gerald Willis is 6'4", 300, and, you know, had like 15 tackles for loss or something last year at Miami. He's a guy who can get in there and maybe not as great against the run, but if the Ravens continue to develop defensive linemen like they have, could definitely be a contributor sometime down the line. But, you know, who knows? We just haven't seen enough to make any kind of definitive conclusion.
All right. So we wanted to get your insider opinion on this, but we need to jump back to the offense here. I'm going to shortcut the rest of the discussion about this offensive line on Bozeman and Powers, because I'll have an article produced later in the week out on filmstudyravens.com that'll have the scoring for Bozeman, Powers, what we had for Hurst with some particulars, and Makari. So look for that later in the week. I want to talk about some individual performances here. And I don't think we can start without talking about the unbelievable performance by Trace McSorley.
Let's do it. I mean, it was something to behold, right? I think after those first two games, you know, you kind of came into the preseason thinking that this was a guy who 90% chance of making that 53-man roster just because of RG3's injury situation, because the Ravens don't like giving up on draft picks, because, you know, he's just a class individual. But then he struggles a little bit, you know, has the interception in both games, both times targeting Miles Boykin. And then, you know, coming out against a fairly representative Eagles defense, just balls out. I mean, you know, doing all the smart things, throwing to the back shoulder of bigger receivers, you know, evading pressure like he's a fifth-year pro. Mm-hmm. Just really, really impressive. And, I mean, I don't know how many Ravens quarterbacks have kind of had that first-half stat line in preseason history like he has. I mean, I think it was like 16 for 14 for 203 yards, something like that, and the two touchdowns. I mean, it was just awesome to behold, wasn't it?
Yeah, big first half. You know, there's so many things I liked, and I do want to mention a few of these, and then I want to get to your comparison that we talked about in the production thing maybe after we do this, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
For me, the big thing was decision making. It wasn't just the results, and the results were fantastic, but it was where he threw the football. It was a lot of that accuracy outside the numbers that we've seen from him and we really haven't seen from Lamar Jackson. In terms of the 44-yard pass to Boykin, the 28-yard touchdown to Floyd was dropped right in the bucket. The incomplete to, who was it? Number 12, Scott. in the end zone was just off, out of reach on his fingertips and perfectly thrown in the sense that it's safe from the receiver. I thought the pass to Boykin on the right sideline that was knee high really should have been caught. Don't know if it, you know, most services would classify it as a drop, but to me it should have been caught. It was a ball that was safely thrown by position. So, I mean, I really loved how he placed the ball in this game. He only had one ball, and it wasn't a high risk. It was in the third quarter where he didn't play nearly as well on the left sideline where he had a ball knocked down that might have been an interception. But it was the only even close to interceptable ball that he really threw all night.
Yeah, and we can talk about, when we get to Miles Boykin, maybe about some of the wide receivers kind of sort of letting him down. But we also have to give them a bit of a pass because someone like Boykin is a rookie and still learning the game, still learning how to run his routes. But yeah, I mean, you know, just talking about how impressive he's been, somewhat inflated by this most recent game. But hey, I think it can't be discounted at all because it is the Eagles and because he was going against starters for as long as he was out there. But, you know, you just take a big picture view, 2019 stat line for Trace. 362 passing yards, 57.1 completion percentage, 3 touchdowns, 2 interceptions, 76.3 passer rating. And you think, okay, that's, you know, that's solid. But again, you have to consider that these are rookies and it is very, very tough to succeed, even when you're going against second string defenses this early in a rookie's career. So I just look back at some of the other recent Ravens rookie quarterbacks they've trotted out there, and obviously, not a whole lot of big names. You had Tyrod Taylor in 2011, Joe Flacco in 2008, Kyle Bowler 2003, and then you have random guys like Keith Wenning 2014, Josh Harris 2004, some guy named Wes Pate in 2002.
Oh, a long time ago. There you go. Seventh round draft pick.
Yeah. Finished with a remarkable 2 of 3 passing for 25 yards, no touchdowns. Also no interceptions for a bountiful 92.4 rating, which is somewhat inflated. But yeah, you know, just looking at the passer rating, you know, with Trace's 362 yards, he's on pace to pass what Tyrod Taylor finished with. Tyrod had a 66.5 rating, 408 passing yards, a touchdown, and 3 interceptions three years earlier during Joe Flacco's first year. He had only a 52.2% completion rate, 284 yards, 1 touchdown, 0 picks, 68.3 rating. Chris Redman back in 2000, a bunch of yards, 364 yards passing, but a little less accurate. He was 37 for 62, had a touchdown and interception, 74.9 ratings, which leaves the undisputed champion of Ravens rookie preseason quarterbacks, Mr. Kyle Bowler. 2003, 356 passing yards. A solid but not great 58.9% completion rate, and then 4 touchdowns, 1 interception. I think he was helped by one big game toward the end of that preseason, but he finished with a pretty good-looking 86.4 rating. So, you know, if Trace can keep it up, and you think he probably would. I know the Redskins have a pretty deep defense, but again, they are also going to be starting their backups. You know, for the Ravens, you wonder if that means that they will also not put out someone like Miles Boykin, who Trace has had kind of a hot and cold relationship with. But, you know, if he's been doing what he if he does more what he did of on Thursday than he did in the previous 2 weeks, you're looking at a guy who's really, really done an impressive job. And, you know, it's kind of obvious accepted wisdom at this point, but it's really going to be tough to you know, have him snuck onto that practice squad because some team is going to want him as their second or third-string quarterback.
I hear you on that. I'm not entirely convinced that that's true of Trace, is that he would be snapped up by someone. A lot of teams have their system in place, and they already have their second guy in place. And the two preseason opponents of the Ravens may be two of the best chances. I mean, Philadelphia just picked up Josh McClown is what I want to say. But, you know, he's you know, almost 40 years old, whatever he is. He's 17 years in the league. I mean, that is a move of utter and complete desperation. I mean, it's not a developmental move. That's for certain. If you have your starting quarterback go down, I guess if you're a team like the Eagles, you might really try and get by with Josh McCown and see if you can make the playoffs. If you want to have any kind of development out of the position, so maybe you have a less good team like the Jacksonville Jaguars, say, he'd make a lot of sense. you know, instead of Minshew, instead of some of their other choices for a backup quarterback. So it's an interesting choice to me in terms of whether or not he'd be taken by somebody. But I do think he's a guy you might just roll the dice with for a week and try and decide, you know, is there somebody else I really need for 8 weeks this year? You
know, right.
You come back at week 9, week 8, whatever the rule is for IRDTR.
One team, I'm not sure if you saw this, Ken, but one team that is in need of a quarterback, the Indianapolis Colts. Have you seen this?
I did
Andrew
not.
Andrew Luck has informed the Colts per Adam Schefter that he is retiring from the NFL.
Oh, my God. That's huge. That just happened the last few minutes here?
Yeah, 31 minutes ago, per
Schefter. Wow, okay. I'm paying too much attention to the show here. You clearly have that reporter's
No, I just got a Slack message from my editor.
Well, that's good to hear, because the Colts are one of the teams that would have been a threat, and the last thing I want to see is the Irsay family to win anything, as most Baltimoreans would agree.
There you go.
So I did want to talk about two other things I saw from McSorley in this game, because we're talking about a lot of the roster things and whatnot, which are significant, but I wanted to get back to this, is that one of the things that was really made clear in this game is that Trace does not really have the speed to run the read option attack.
Yeah.
And he had, if the opponent is disciplined at all, you know, you often still will get Jackson on the edge with a one-on-one situation to beat a man for a medium gain, say one between 5 and 10 yards. And he was twice put in that position and twice taken down behind the line of scrimmage on those plays. And And they're separated by the – they're in the article if you want to go out on the website to look at that. The other thing I really like, though, is he's had now in 3 games 2 incredibly impressive end-of-half drives. One was a minute and 11. They drove 69 yards against the Eagles on 10 plays. First of all, he's a rookie. A minute and 11, and I think the actual thing lasted 64 seconds was the length of the drive. He got off 10 plays. That's remarkable. Yeah. You know, that's poised to get to the line of scrimmage, to be able to do things like that, to get the ball out of bounds, to have your team on the same page. And then the four play drive in 20 seconds against Jacksonville that should have been a touchdown but was negated by Sanat's holding call and got called back. That was a touchdown to Boykin, I think, in the end zone. And then they kicked the field goal anyway. I mean, you have to go back to Stoney Case in 1999 to find a guy who had 2 end-of-half drives that impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that was just the reputation on – that was the book on Trace kind of coming out of Penn State, right? He's just always been a winner, always been a gamer. He was a guy who was recruited out of Briarwoods High School in North Virginia as kind of a safety, and then continued to win as a quarterback, won the job at a big-time program like Penn State, and, you know, just really a guy it's easy to count out, but when you do, as soon as you do it, he'll make you look bad. I mean – I think he's a guy who probably commands the pocket pretty well just from his natural leadership ability. But obviously you have to have the arm strength and the know-how to kind of make those sideline throws that he's doing that, like you said, kind of amount to these 10 play drives in under a minute or so. So it's definitely really impressive.
Yeah. All right. Well, some of the other players in this game, so we got some of the comparison of the other rookie quarterbacks in there. Let's have a quick talk about Miles Boykin, just because he seems to be at the heart of all of the Ravens' plans, whether it's this year we're talking about or this preseason specifically. He's a frequent target.
Yeah. It was interesting. I forget. I think this kind of epitomized the rough edges on Miles Boykin. Obviously, you had the 45-yard or whatever it was catch and run in yesterday's game, but I think it was in the preseason game against the Packers. He had that in breaking route, I think it was a slant, where he kind of rounded it out very, very awkwardly, and it ended up being a near interception that traced through. I think it might have been off of Boykin's hands. And then maybe off of a Packers player's hands or whatever. But just watching the replay, if I'm remembering it correctly, it just kind of stood out because it looked like Miles decided he was going to run at one angle. And then like a step or a step and a half later, he kind of changed the direction. And obviously, when you're a receiver, you want to make that cut decisive because you want to tell the quarterback
right
with your body language as soon as possible where exactly you're going. And so it looked at first glance like it was a bad throw by Trace. I kind of wanted to give more of the blame to Boykin, and I think they're both fortunate that ball wasn't picked off. But, you know, just looking at some of the advanced metric stuff on Boykin coming out of Notre Dame, I think it was something like 45% of his total receiving yardage was either on go routes or mm-hmm. out routes, which are obviously probably the simplest. Those are the simplest, yeah. the least sophisticated routes that you can run. And you know, obviously the Notre Dame coaches want to put him in a position to succeed, which he absolutely did, having as great of a season as he did toward the end of the year there. But, you know, he's not a guy who maybe has the know-how to run the kind of routes that someone like Willie Snead would. Obviously, Booking is an outside receiver, Snead's an inside receiver, so that kind of changes their route trees. But he's a guy who, you know, is obviously, despite all these big flashy plays he's making, is still going to have to know how to create space for himself if he can only run a certain number of routes.
Well, yes, that's the problem I have not had with him. I mean, particularly on the 17 plus 27 down the left sideline, he did a great job of creating space within that triangle of defenders who was around him. And he had the advantage, Baldinger talked about this too, that Brown was running the slot route on that side and drew off two defenders. So he was able to get his guy turned, that edge defender who had to use the boundary and then cover Boykin, got him turned around, and then he made his turn, caught the ball, and was able to actually then evade that defender as well for the big gain after the catch. I've been happy with the space he's created. What I think he's got to do is he not only has to become a less of a dropper, which has obviously been a problem, but he needs to become a bad ball catcher. So, you know, become what Chris Moore is. Be able to go get the ball wherever it's thrown. You know, throw your body around to do it, take chances to do it. But if he could do that, then he's the perfect complement to Lamar Jackson, who probably is going to be challenged, at least for the foreseeable future, in terms of his accuracy to the body on the throw. He'll be able to throw receivers open, and Boykin can get to a ball under those circumstances. So can a lot of receivers, a lot of the receivers the Ravens have. But I think that when he's thrown a ball otherwise, when he's open already in space, he's going to need to be able to catch those bad balls. And that includes that ball at the knees on the right sideline. It was just a ball that was half to be caught. And it's got to be a bigger catch radius than that he really affords a quarterback like Jackson. So I actually like the space he's created on this. I was pleasantly surprised that he's done this. You may bring up a great point about the one slant route that nearly got intercepted, but I've been otherwise very impressed with the amount of space he's created.
Yeah, and you wonder just how much of it is him maybe – I mean, it's dumb to speculate on something that's like this, but just him going back and forth between having to learn how to catch a Lamar ball versus a Trace ball. I don't know how much of a material difference there is in terms of, you know, anticipating their windup or anticipating where they'll kind of lead you as a receiver when you're out there. But obviously, you know, he's been in training camp or he's been with the Ravens for less than a full month of work now, if you're not including those spring workouts, which you really shouldn't, because remember, he was out for a good bit of the offseason practices with whatever injury he had. I forget exactly what it was. But yeah, I mean, he's definitely been extremely, extremely promising. And, you know, he's not going to be probably a 800-yard guy, because that is just, I think, very, very unrealistic for pretty much any rookie receiver. But if they can get 500 yards, 600 yards out of him, I think that would be a heck of a first season for him.
Yeah, I do too. And I think he's a player who ought to already be trying to figure out what should he be doing with his offseason this year. There's a lot of players at this age not having a contract year in the coming up the very next year that won't think to invest in themselves during the offseason. But boy, if you can do it before the year three, year four crossover, meaning you don't wait till after year three to invest in your own career to become a better receiver. And it's receiving skills that he needs. It's how to make cuts, how to run routes better, hand placement, how to close on the ball, how to keep his eyes on the ball, all of those things that would make him a better receiver. He can learn, and he's got all the physical tools known to man. I mean, he's just got everything.
Yeah. And I think, I don't think he had a tremendous catch rate at Notre Dame, but I think he didn't have he had a pretty good catch rate. I think his drop rate was just a little bit lower in terms of the percentiles. So that may be somewhat of a nagging issue, but again, it's just compensated by that higher than otherwise just catch rate, because that I think is just more of a testament to his wingspan, his body, his speed, his ability to go up and get possible jump balls. So I think whatever shortcomings there may be with his hands, which I'm sure he'll work on, he's a very diligent, smart guy. His just natural athleticism will probably compensate for that.
All right, great. Marquise Brown's debut, we need a hit on that, obviously. I was excited from Scheme. I was excited for the two bad balls he went out to get, one to the outside, which he kind of pulled in with one hand and then secured. The other one he went up high for, you know, to the height that a normal 6-foot human might get it. And made a nice catch on the left sideline. Didn't do anything after the catch, but I'm not concerned about that yet. Obviously, the route implications on that left sidelines, what he did for Boykin is very exciting in terms of how he might draw off defenders. And then the last thing was that I love the fact they ran the jet sweep, even though he ran only three times in his entire college career for 0 yards. I love the fact that they did that, because the defensive coordinators around the league will be looking at that when they play the Ravens and have to figure out how to stop it. And I've got to think edge defenders are going to tend to be frozen an extra quarter step because of it.
Yeah, and just kind of thinking about how the Ravens will use him, I think Michael Crawford, Abukari on Twitter was talking about the Ravens diamond formation and how they kind of use it on those two early plays with the Justice Hill blown up run, but then the quick pass out to was it Floyd, the kind of one where they just pulled back and threw it to the guy out on the right. Do you remember who that was, Ken?
I'm trying to think of the play you're talking about. Even
the diamond formation where the cornerback kind of crept in thinking that it was going to be a run, and there was maybe a play action, but McSorley just threw it out to the right, and it was a pretty simple 5-10 yard reception.
Okay.
Anyway, that is a formation that I think, if you think about from a kind of micro perspective with Marquise Brown and the Ravens personnel that they have, you know, just looking online for the necessary components to build a diamond formation, this footballstudyhall.com article on SB Nation, you need to have a good running back, which the Ravens certainly have one of, maybe two with Gus and Mark Ingram. Lead blockers, they certainly have that with Nick Boyle. Hayden Hurst should also be a pretty good blocker. And then you also need a vertical threat on the outside who can abuse a one-on-one matchup, and as well as a quarterback who can hit him downfield. And you could obviously say that, you know, someone like Miles Boykin could be that guy because he has great physical tools. But I think you also want a guy who just the mere threat of him on the field gets the kind of cushion that Marquise Brown was getting on every single play out there on Thursday. I mean, it seemed like only when the Ravens got to the goal line did the Eagles actually bother to have a guy more than, you know, closer than 5 yards against Marquise, because they had so much respect for him. And it was actually surprising that they didn't try to jam him. I'm not sure if it was a kind of gentleman's agreement between Harbaugh and the Eagles coaching staff, like, hey, this guy's, you know, still kind of coming out of the bubble wrap. Let's treat him right. But obviously they wouldn't have tried to tap him as seriously as if that was the case. But I mean, if it's a guy who can take the top off the defense with a go route, which he looked just absolutely explosive, just kind of coming out of cuts on Thursday. But he's also a guy who, if Lamar wants to just abort, you know, an RPO and throw a simple out route to, or, you know, just a simple throw to Marquise out of the boundary and get like 5-6 yards, just like, you know, finding free money basically, because it's going to be a 95% throw. And if Marquise Brown breaks it, then you have a huge amount of trouble on your hands. So yeah. I think, you know, just all the kind of wrinkles that a guy like that gives the Ravens offensively is really, really exciting to think about.
Yeah, they've got to find a way certainly to loosen up the box in general. And a player like Brown, also a player like Boykin as well, are two guys that will really help do that. There's one other thing I really liked from Marquise Brown in this game, and that was he's not dissimilar to John Brown in some ways. You got both fast, short receivers. Brown is obviously, Hollywood is obviously more shifty than John. But what I liked was he continued to run the route on that two-point conversion after the play was done, quote-unquote, and McSorley had extended it. And he found space in the back of the end zone for that completion. It was called back by holding, but it was still a very nice play for Brown to extend that play. And I am salivating for that with Lamar Jackson, who is one of the great play extenders in this league. You know, if we want to get a Pat Mahomes-like result out of Jackson, a lot of his value that he has to layer on is going to be on those extended plays. And I think he's now going to have some of the weapons with Hill on the field and maybe Brown on the field at the same time to really find some receivers on extended plays.
Yeah, and this is, let me preface this by saying this is not a Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson comparison, but it was Tyreek Hill, a guy who, is, if it's not Marquise Brown, might be the fastest guy in the NFL, who caught that huge, huge fourth down
conversion.
When Mahomes extended it, you know, just barely escaping, I think, Matthew Judon in that game last December. So, you know, I think Marquise Brown, he's a guy that Marlon Humphrey said, even when he was rehabbing like 2 or 3 weeks ago, was hitting 20, 21 miles per hour on these, the technology that these guys are wearing, which is obviously very, very exciting. And just, I wish there was all 22 game footage for this game, because I wasn't watching the game as much as some of my colleagues because I was having to write the gamer pretty quickly in that first half. But from what they were telling me, they were saying, oh yeah, Marquise was open on this one, Marquise was open on that one, and you know, Lamar just wasn't seeing him or wasn't getting to him in his progression. So if you take their words for you know, just as truth, then I think that's a good sign that he was able to get open pretty easily.
Yeah, it's a good point. And yeah, you don't get that on NFL Game Pass. I do want to encourage people, and this is the time of year, if you're a Ravens season ticket holder, please get your Game Pass subscription. Even if you're not sure if you want it, you have an email there that'll give you a free Game Pass subscription as a PSL holder, and you'll have an additional option in terms of reading my work, because I give you those quarter and time references to go back and look at the plays that I'm citing. So I'd love for more people to take advantage of that if they can. Let's go on a little bit, because we kind of need to get through the remainder of these players. Hayden Hurst, the only thing I had to say about this is that he's now got 2 catches on 6 yards for 9 yards this preseason.
Yeah.
I cannot sugarcoat that in any way in terms of what's happened. And the clock is really running on him. If the clock is running out, quote unquote, on Bowser and Williams, well, Hurst is older than both of those guys. And the Ravens
26
have
as of today, right?
Yeah, 26 today. So the Ravens have him for 4 years here if they want him for all 4 of those years. But he's going to have to show us something in these next couple of years to be sure to be here for 5.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this when I saw your outline. You know, just last year, obviously, was a disappointment. And I think the hope is that the Hurst that we see this year will be just completely unrecognizable from the Hurst that we saw last year. And I think I should preface this by saying that Hurst has been very, very impressive in training camp and in practice. And there have been days when he's been better than Mark Andrews, who just looks like, you know, potential NFL conqueror this year. But you look at last year, he had 103 yards, not great, but along the lines of just the poor catch rate, he was targeted 23 times and he only caught 13. And
not good for a tight end.
And it wasn't like Lamar Jackson had problems targeting tight ends, because Mark Andrews was uber efficient whenever he was thrown to. Even Max Williams, I think, caught all but one pass thrown his way last year, I believe. So, you know, it may just be, I think in this case, it's probably just bad, you know, case of small sample sizes for this preseason for Hayden Hurst, considering what we've seen in practice. But, you know, it may be that he just becomes more of a red zone weapon than a kind of middle of the field weapon, a guy who can just, you know, shrug off linebackers, safeties, whatever. And maybe he, you know, finishes the year with like 40 catches, but 10 of them are touchdowns. Who knows? But I agree that his lack of a big time play through these 3 weeks is it definitely makes you raise your eyebrow a little bit. But I think if you saw what we've been seeing at practice and at training camp, I think you should hold off on, you know, raising the alarm bells for now.
I do expect him to be a big part of the Ravens offense this year. I just need to start seeing some indication of it. Brown didn't have that great a game in terms of his total yards of this game, but you can see all sorts of indications about what's special about Hollywood Brown. What I want to know is, when's Hurst going to use his body effectively to make a catch? When is Hurst going to get some separation to find a hole in zone coverage the way tight ends are wont to do? You know, when is Hurst going to otherwise be able to start making some contested catches and earn the quarterback's trust maybe to do so. I mean, he had one play at this game where he was overthrown in the end zone. Now, there was pressure on McSorley on the play, but it's the kind of play where I'd have been tempted to just give Hurst the chance to box out the defender and make the catch.
And one question I have for you, Ken. I know you're focusing mainly on the blocking efficiency of the actual O lineman, but has Hurst done anything negatively or positively in your opinion there?
As a tight end, I don't score the tight end separately. Okay. So and Hurst is not normally the first in line tight end.
Right.
So if Boyle is on the field, he would normally be the guy. So he hasn't had the same sorts of opportunities. In Hurst's case, honestly, I think the better that we can hope for, the more reasonable hope, is not that he'd be a great inline tight end. He'll be effective enough, but that he'll be a good downfield run blocking tight end because the Ravens do so much of that.
Yeah, I think, you look at the two positions besides quarterback, obviously, that are going to be affected the most by the Ravens kind of hiding Lamar versus fully unleashing him when the regular season comes. I think it's running back, and I think it's going to be tight end because there's so much interplay there with the play action and the RPO and the stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, growing up watching RG3 on the Washington Redskins, it was just money in the bank every time. It was a play action, and then you just dump it to, whatever tight end was kind of coming across, getting behind the linebackers who had to respect that run threat. And if you have a capable tight end, who's a capable blocker at tight end, rather, and if Hayden Hurst is that guy, then that's a little bit more respect earned from maybe someone like Mark Andrews, who's obviously a better receiver, but maybe a little bit less respected as a potential blocker. So, if you want to be that all-around tight end, I think Hayden Hurst could be that guy, and maybe that fits better on some drives for the Ravens than Mark Andrews. But again, that's also what Nick Boyle is there for. So it's really tough to tell how that'll work out. But I think just with the threat of play action, with the threat of Lamar holding a linebacker, a spy, I think the tight ends are really going to be a lot more effective in the regular season than what we've seen in the preseason so far.
Yeah. I it's a good point. And, obviously being paired with Lamar is a different situation. Let's move on a little bit. Michael Floyd had his first three catches of the preseason, 54 yards. Looked good, I thought, in general, in making those three out of four grabs. I kind of want to go a little bit quicker here, but what do you have to say about Michael?
Yeah, I was happy for him. I mean, I think he'd only been targeted just once during the first two games, and that was a defensive pass interference call that he drew. It was just kind of one of those weird cognitive dissonance things where he'd been playing better in training camp, especially in those joint practices against the Eagles. So you wondered whether it would fully translate, and it finally did. And I'm happy for him. I mean, he's a guy who's been through a lot. Obviously, some of his foibles are of his own making, but I think he got married in the offseason. He seems very happy if you just judge him by his social media presence. So I'm looking forward to hopefully talking to him this week and just getting a sense for where he is mentally.
That sounds good. I mean, I've liked his sideline awareness in this game, both in terms of the pass interference call he drew earlier, which had some of that, but more on this touchdown catch in terms of making the throw, being able to toe tap, also stay in bounds for the extra 3 yards, because that's a high leverage 3 yards to get in the end zone at that point. I didn't like the mistiming of his leap on the 2-point conversion. It appeared to me he probably should have had that ball. He just jumped too early and was on the way down already when it sailed over his head.
Yeah, was that the one where there was a kind of good amount of hand fighting with the defensive back there?
Left side of the end zone. I think the one you're talking about might be Jaleel Scott.
Okay,
talking about the left side of the end zone with Floyd. He was fairly well open by a step or so, and he mistimed his leap and came down. I thought was already on the way down when the ball flew over his head.
Yeah, I mean, Floyd also went up and failed to get a pass from Lamar Jackson during an otherwise really, really good practice from him a couple of weeks ago. So, maybe just a guy who's not as capable of being that kind of high flyer that he was in the past when he was a first round pick, which obviously limits his effectiveness and what he could do potentially in this offense as an outside receiver. But still, has the know-how to get open, obviously.
Right. So the way I'm looking at the wide receiver battle right now is just take a moment to talk about this. There are four guys who I think are set with Moore, Brown, Boykin, and Snead.
Yep.
And then I think you've got three guys fighting for either one or two spots, depending on how the Ravens want to do it. three or four guys, you could say. Wesley, to me, is on the outside right now because I think that Scott has separated himself from him.
I agree.
So I would say Scott's ahead of him on the list now. And then you have Floyd and you have Roberts, who's now coming back from injury, right, who I don't think is a sure thing to make the roster at this point.
No, I think he's of those guys. I think he's definitely has the best odds, but I think Thursday will definitely be big just to see how he's holding up physically and whether he can produce against second and third string defensive backs.
All right. All right. Well, outstanding. And let's see, what else do we have to go through before we go through this? Let's talk team MVPs. I think we talked about enough of the individual players here. So we usually, I like to go 3-1 on the MVPs in this game. You can play along or not if you like. Forgot what we decided already, whether you're going to do this or not.
I will say my piece and then clear the lane for you. I will just say that my special teams MVP is none other than Carly Lloyd for kicking a 55-yard field goal and continuing just what has been a brilliant summer for the U.S. women's national team.
Yeah, they are so much fun to watch. The women and the men were on the same day once this summer. And the men's game is unwatchable.
Yeah.
Unwatchable. And the women's game was so exciting. They're exciting individually. They have the actual character difference. One of the things about the women's hockey team that I noticed is the women look very similar. A lot of them all have that very tall Scandinavian look about them. The women's soccer team, very different looking girls. I mean, you got to identify them on the field more easily. It's more fun to watch the game. They're very much individuals and exciting to watch.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of 5-2 players like Crystal Dunn in the men's game.
No. Carly Lloyd taking the extra steps is something that I've heard a complaint. It seems kind of mean-spirited to this. I mean, we know she's not going to kick in the NFL, but still, it seems a little silly to talk about.
I know.
Her to a standard 3x2 kicker, you know. Kind
of thing. And she was kicking on the narrow goalpost, people. Let's give her some credit.
Did not notice that. That's impressive.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, I'll go through my offensive MVP since we're running kind of over here. The nice thing about not having sponsors is we don't really care about that. So we'll take it as long as we want, and people can use two commutes to listen if they want. Marquise Brown, my number three MVP. More for all the scheme he portends for what he did in this game than what he did in this game in terms of yardage, obviously. But very exciting player, and love what he brings to the team.
Yeah, I mean, I think if only Marquise Brown were healthy for the week two game, and then we could have maybe seen him kind of take that lateral pass that Joe Horn Jr. took against the Packers. I mean, maybe it is amazing just kind of what the Ravens are deciding to show and not show, because some of it could be just construed as braggadocious. Like, yeah, look at all these tools that we have in our playbook that we are going to show. But obviously, you talk to guys and they say that there's so much more that they haven't even shown. So who knows? I tend to agree with them considering just all the exotic stuff that Greg Roman has done in the past.
The nature of the Ravens offense, because it's so run heavy, and it'll change this year a little bit, but I still believe it'll be run heavy. They'll try and win play count by a lot. They'll try and manage defensive snaps and have a very low defensive snap count in total to help them win games. Because that's the philosophy, they really need to layer on more and more new stuff every week as they go through the season. So I completely understand the desire to hold back on the playbook.
Right. Yeah. And they've talked about how one of the goals of building this playbook was just making it digestible and comprehensible to all the players. And obviously millennials learn a different way than guys coming in into the league 20 years ago. So that is going to be something that's going to be interesting. It seems like, I mean, Lamar Jackson is the most important player in terms of understanding the offense. And he says that in terms of his pre-snap reads and his pre-snap audibles and everything, he's just, it's night and day compared to, you know, what he was having to do last year, which is, a very encouraging sign if you're a Ravens fan.
All right. My number two on the game MVP is Michael Floyd. Nice toe tap down the left sideline for that 28-yard touchdown. Too bad on the 2-point conversion. Other catches, got him up to 54 yards with 26 others. A lot to like there, and he's reinserted himself into that discussion for that last wide receiver spot, second to last spot.
Yeah, I mean, turning 30 years old in November, so the clock is ticking. But we'll see if he just how well he does Thursday. I think that's going to be a make or break game for him, just like a lot of players.
Yeah, this is a good spot for Floyd to be in as a wide receiver at age 30, because he could be a cut for a lot of teams. But the Ravens are A, a contender, and B, they already have a lot of their youth taken care of in Brown and Boykin. So they don't need additional youth projects. So a player like Scott, while he's an exciting possibility, the Ravens don't have as many obvious snaps to develop him over the future, where a guy like Floyd, who could play immediately and help them right now, might be of more value in the Ravens system and in the Ravens current organizational history than for a lot of other teams in the NFL.
Yeah, although it must be said, I'm not sure how much of this portends for the week one snap counts on special teams, but Jaleel Scott has been getting a lot of run on special teams. For an offensive guy, I think he had maybe the most or the second most special team snaps among the guys on offense. Obviously getting a lot of work at gunner. Seems like if and when Justin Bethel makes the team, he has one of those gunner spots wrapped up. But I don't know who they have in mind for the other one. But if Jaleel Scott makes the team and what they've seen in preseason is enough, then he could be a guy who could be active on game day, because it seems like he's done some good work out there.
Yeah, great point here. So DeLance Turner, of the offense players, led in special team snaps with 11. And Jaleel Scott was second with 9. Nobody else had more than 6. That was Chris Moore, who we certainly think of as a special teams ace. Right. But anyway, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's a great indicator for whether or not they're going to make the week one roster is how much special teams play are they getting.
Yeah, and I guess with you mentioning it, probably would be Chris Moore. He seems like the obvious candidate outside of Bethel.
All right. Let's see. My number one, pretty obviously, Trace McSorley in this game. We've talked about a lot of this already. We don't need to go over it again. Just very impressed with that poise. Very impressed with the sideline throws.
Doing it in Pennsylvania. Penn State guy. It's got to be happy.
All right. Josh, what do you have for us in the mailbag this
week? Yeah, we got a few things in the mailbag tonight. Teased some of them yesterday because we're going to focus on the offensive ones today. You can steer the show by using the hashtag Film Study Mailbag on Twitter or commenting over at filmstudyravens.com. And we're going to start there tonight with some questions that came in on the website. First one up is from Dirk, who says, Mike Preston noticed that the Ravens need to work with Orlando Brown Jr. on his stance, that he's tipping plays, even an easy read in practice. What's your guys' take on this?
Ken, you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start, but I'm not sure I have that much to say. Oftentimes, I have a problem with the whole tipping thing. And I know the Chargers claim some things that they saw from Ronnie Stanley. I then looked at it. It's not obvious the exact tendency, but someone has pointed out on Purple Flock in particular, a guy we're hoping to have on this show in a couple of weeks, that there was a tendency for him when pulling right to not go all the way down into a three-point stance. When he pulled left, he did go into a three-point stance. That's just not that many plays for the Chargers to pick up on what's going. So I have some real questions about that. Now, it could be Brown is getting lazy, and if so, they ought to be looking at that on film and say, thanks for pointing that out. We'll try and get that corrected. But I don't think it's anything physically that should hold Brown back. I think he just needs to think about what he's doing at worst.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, I think on some plays, if it's a 3rd and 10, you really aren't concerned too much if you're tipping that it's a pass play, because what else is it going to be? So I think if there's anything that's the obvious to it, then I think the Ravens probably know what it is, know what the deal is, and just counting on Orlando to kick it into order come week one, because if he doesn't, then they really have a real problem.
All right. I think also Raven fans are a little sensitive about the whole topic of the line giving up the play.
All right, yeah, I mean, the last play of the Raven season was basically him, blowing a block and allowing a sack. So I think that sensitivity is very well earned.
All right. Do you think the Ravens will cut or trade Kenneth Dixon? Everyone seems to be down on him, but I think he's too valuable to move on from.
Go ahead. I think at this point, with him missing Thursday's game and just his constant state of, is he healthy, is he not healthy, it's going to be a really tough sell for a team. I mean, maybe the Jets are interested because they are interested in pretty much every Ravens player who they don't want. But gosh, I mean, I think a lot of Ravens fans, and deservedly so, are kind of fixating on that quote from the Ravens running backs coach saying that Dixon is the most talented rusher on the field. And obviously, he had a great yards per carry last year, but he's not a guy who's going to give you anything on special teams. He's never been a guy who can give you that. And I don't think he hasn't really shown that much as a receiver after that, that rookie year or whenever it was that he kind of broke out. So I think at this point, a cut is more likely. If you're trading him, it's for peanuts, basically.
Right. I mean, I'll say this. As a receiver, he's not getting as many opportunities because he's not a good pass blocker. So yeah. If you don't do those two things well together, there's not a lot of reason for you to be in on third down. So that role, I think, will go more likely to Ingram and possibly some to Hill this year. Hill, I don't know if you caught it in this game. On the 44-yard throw to Boykin, he made a Hall of Fame cut block to maintain ample time and space. Yeah. Upended the linebacker on the play, so very impressive. Dixon. I think you can trade him for a conditional 7. It's possible, but I just don't think there's a lot of teams eager to trade you a conditional 7 knowing that he's going to be on the market. They'll take their chances because if it's not Dixon, it'll be somebody else. And they don't think there's that much differentiation. It could be DeLance Turner is somebody they want just as badly. The Ravens are probably going to cut him. And, he's shown a little bit as a receiver and as a runner, and he could be the guy that some other team wants.
Yeah, and to follow up on that Hill note, not only did he have that great takeout block, but on that Mark Andrews catch and run kind of sort of near the goal line, just watching the replay this afternoon, he stepped up and really took on a blitz extremely well. He gave a little bit of ground, but for a guy who's about 200 pounds, it was pretty impressive how, he recognized the blitz, stepped in there, and did a pretty good job of holding his ground.
Yeah, at his hip weight, he really needs to attack the body. So I saw him taking that block standing up, and I wasn't really happy about it. But that's okay. We're on the same page on that. I also liked that Justice Hill on the right side, when McSorley had the 4-yard run, actually obstructed one of the players in the end zone. I think it was Hawkins, and helped McSorley get in the end zone, because McSorley obviously was down to the last inch or so there. And to have that extra moment of obstruction was good. We can gush over Hill all day because he just does something exciting even when he's not doing much in the way of yardage very often.
Yeah, that spin move was something else.
All right. One more question from the mailbag. We're going to go with Carolyn's question, who is referring to Coach Billick referred to the odd failed play with 4 on each side as the Daffy Duck play. Can you elaborate on this play? I'd be interested in the history and last time it was used and what it was meant to accomplish.
Okay. I know a little bit about that, and I believe the Ravens may have used it 3 times in game action, but I didn't go back to find the exact years. So, Carolyn, I'm going to promise you I will tweet when they used that formation previously. But I remember it coming up on one occasion. It was perhaps as much as a decade ago with players on the outside, the 3-3-3 at the line, quarterback and running back as well.
And I couldn't tell from my spot in the press box, but I think Jeff Zrebeck sitting next to me said that Harbaugh was pretty pissed after that play, because if you remember, it was only might have gone for no yards or just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that, just from reading those signs, because obviously it couldn't have been anything wrong with the officiating because the play was held up. And I imagine that the Eagles had just 11 players on the field like they were supposed to, that maybe he was mad at McSorley and it was a read that he missed on that, because it looked like it ended up being like 3 against 4 in the middle of that defense.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the read should have been to throw it out wide and, take the chances with those guys, the linemen and the tight ends and the wide receivers who were out to whatever side that you favor, taking chances with them. But it looked to me like McSorley probably didn't read the play right, or maybe just thought that I don't know. It was a weird play, but I'm in all in favor of those kind of bizarre formations.
Yeah, I love it. It really forces you, I think, not to substitute on that play, because you don't want to give the defense a chance to substitute or have an excuse why the play can be held up and they can get a line properly. So I don't know if they did or not on that play. It should have been, I believe it was on a second down play. Without a substitution, that would have been the way to go there.
Now, this isn't the same play the Patriots used that upset Harbaugh like last year, right? No. It's a different play?
No, completely different. Okay. This is a formation the Ravens actually came up with long before that playoff game in 2014. The playoff game in 2014, the objection to it is that when you declare yourself eligible, you are a change in personnel. And Harbaugh's claim is that you should then be able to substitute on defense to counter that personnel switch. Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, that's going to do it for the mailbag. People keep asking on Twitter how to help out film study. And the big thing is to spread the word, share the website, share the podcast, and write a review in your podcast app. And it's been a while since we've promoted that, and I've noticed that some have came in, so I thought we'd take the next couple of episodes and we'd highlight one each week. So just last week, there was a new comment: among the best sports podcasts. This is an insightful, independent-minded podcast that transcends just its amazing value to Ravens fans. I listen to regularly about 22 sports podcasts across different sports and leagues, and to me, this is the peak of what is available anywhere. Independent, meticulous analysis is rare in sports world, where herd mentality and groupthink rule, but not with Ken. He could put an expensive paywall in front of his content, and a lot of people would pay for it, but he treats his writing and podcast with the care one would give to a daughter or son. He never mails it in and never fails to deliver insights. Listen to this for a year, and you'll find yourself having more insights. Thanks, Ken. You are the pinnacle of what other podcasters seek to do.
That's unbelievable. Maureen took a lot of time to write that. She's not that good a writer, and to hear her do that, no.
Yeah,
we really appreciate these kind of comments, folks. And you know, hopefully this will help people find the podcast easier. Is that the end result?
Yeah, it helps. It helps with the rankings in the podcast app. And come on, if you read that review, you're going to check out the podcast.
I hope you will.
That's a huge praise. So, all right. So, Jonas, you can plug the Baltimore Sun, where all your writing is, as well as your Twitter. Is there anything specific that you'd like to share and plug with our listeners?
No, just, you know, keep your, you know, eyes tuned to BaltimoreSun.com for coverage. Read the paper if you're a subscriber. You can follow me on Twitter at Jonas_Schaefer, JONAS. _Schaefer, SHAFFER, no C in Schaefer. That is a very important point. And I will plug also, this is for the previous mailbagger, the Emery and Henry formation is apparently what the formation is called. It dates to the 1950s, where Emory and Henry College's team used it. So if you want a little bit of a nighttime reading, or whenever you're bored of work, just Google that. You can look at all the weird various formations. I found this on Wikipedia, so thanks, Wikipedia.
Very cool. I don't know how you looked it up so quickly, but that's terrific, Jonas. That's fantastic stuff. Now, we've given you a little bit of introduction to Jonas, and he's new to Baltimore. He's just the lead beat writer this year for the Ravens. He's got only 1,500 followers on Twitter. You've just heard this guy talk. All he knows about football, all the inside information he can give you. If you're not following him, get on it, guys. You know, we'll be sure to give him a plug on Twitter here. But, you know, get in the conversation with him. He's very approachable. He came to our analytics forum when we did that, because he's just a good football fan, wants to hear about stuff. I mean, I you're going to like this guy, and you want to interact with him if you can.
Dumbest guy in the room, but I was happy to be there.
Ken, no way.
Ken, I like how you're throwing that out there, like 1,500's low. Like he's got some catch up for you to do.
I didn't mean that at all.
No. I am well aware of my standing in the social media pecking order, but hey, I am not going to let that define me.
I'm looking up at Jeff Zrebeck, and who's got five times as many followers or more than that than I do, and thinking that way, but that's where you ought to be.
I have more hair than both you guys, so that's what I look at myself with.
You go for that now.
Right.
Your hair is gone.
And that's why we all held back when you bashed the millennials, not us. So, all right, Ken, what's up on filmstudyravens.com? What is coming?
Okay, now we got two cool things still to come this week. First of all, we'll have this podcast, but that'll be out once you know that. The defense grades are out there currently. So that's a +3 to -3 for all the players on the fringe of the roster, not just the ones we talk about tonight that we took an hour and, 30 minutes to talk about here so far tonight. But you're beyond that. We're going to have offensive line scoring later this week for four players. Hurst, which I've already given you a little look into tonight, Bozeman, Macari, and Powers will have. And I don't like to do all the linemen. It just doesn't really make sense for the preseason. But we'll do those, and I'll put out a small piece on that. And then at the end of this week, the plan is I'm going to do a presentation I did at the Analytics Forum, which only a few people saw, online on either a live stream or more likely a recorded podcast with video. It's going to allow you to look at what's this defense and identifying the Ravens defense either from your seat or doing so, for analysis purposes to try and record that information quickly. So it's an interesting kind of presentation. You've seen it before, Jonas, in terms of what was there. You were one of the few. And we talk a little bit about when the Ravens use these formations, how often they use these formations, and what they look like.
Yeah, it's all very cool, very unique stuff that you really will not get anywhere else.
Maybe do it on a free night so some of the Ravens can tune in to also learn their playbook a little better. So. All right, guys. Well, it was great conversation like always, and we'll all catch up and continue the conversation offline.
Introducing the Lowe's List for Innovation. While our aisles are filled with innovative products, we've selected our favorites just for you. Like the exclusive Whirlpool washer with industry-first 2-in-1 removable agitator. We love this washer because you can customize any load. And with other smart features to streamline your laundry routine, this product is a must-have for families. Shop the full Lowe's List of top picks at Lowe's.com. Lowe's, home to any budget, home to any possibility. U.S. only.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.